listening to episode 135 of Flick Fights, the official podcast of FlickChart.com. Hello, Flick Charters, and welcome to Flick Fights, the official Flick Chart podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Chase.
I'm Hannah Kiefer.
And I'm Doug Van Hollen.
And we're here to find out which movies are the best of all time through a series of movie matchups head-to-head. And as we battle it out and decide which is the better film, our chart grows and refines to reflect all of our collective taste in movies. If you're not already on Flickchart, head over to flickchart.com, sign up for an account, which is absolutely free, and rank all the movies that you've ever seen in your entire life. And as you've probably already figured out, we've got new co-hosts for Flick Fights. Eric unfortunately had some personal matters, which has pulled him away, and Lou is now taking over as the head honcho on the Random Chatter Podcast Network. So we wish them both well and thank them for all the great discussions that we've had on the show. But we're moving forward, and we're moving forward with two of our favorite past guests, Hannah and Doug, as our new co-hosts. Both Hannah and Doug are bloggers and film buffs on Flickchart, and you can learn more about Hannah from episodes 106 and 127, and about Doug on episode 117. But we've got a lot of re-ranking to do in this episode, so we're going to push straight through and jump right into the Thunderdome.
Two men, hand to hand. No jury, no appeal, no parole. Two men enter, one man leaves.
Weapons?
Anything's possible. Chance decides.
Thunderdome. How do I get in there?
That's easy. Pick a fight.
All right, so the first matchup is Fargo up against Ghostbusters. So, yeah, Ghostbusters is in my top 10. Fargo is in my probably top 100, maybe even top 50. I'd have to check. But I'd be interested to hear what you guys think. Are you guys huge Ghostbusters fans? Or
these are both movies that I am supposed to like a lot more than I do.
Okay.
So they're both ones that I can admire, but I don't feel anything about either one. I've wanted to go back and revisit both, partly for Fargo, because I've gotten really into the TV show, and it's made me think that maybe I'm misremembering what. Maybe I would go back and enjoy the original movie more now. And Ghostbusters, I watched a long time ago, but then actually watched the sequel not that long ago. And I was like, okay, that was okay. And I was like, I bet the first one is better than the sequel. I should probably go back and give the sequel a second shot or the original better a second shot since I enjoyed the sequel pretty well. So they're both ones I've needed to revisit. I think right now, I think Ghostbusters would be higher on my chart, but they're both ones that I am in the very minority on. I know.
Ghostbusters is 434 on my chart. I think it's great. As Nathan said many times, that one of the main benefits of this movie is that you can show it to anyone and they will enjoy it. Except for that one scene. Except for the ghost blowjob scene.
Oh, jeez.
Which destroys the fabric of the storytelling. Because Dan Aykroyd needed a scene. Right? Like, he didn't really have, like, a big silly scene,
right?
This is something that Merlin Mann and John Roderick talked about on their podcast, and it really kind of brought it into clarity for me. And that, like, not that that scene ruins the movie, but it show it once your eyes start to see the code of the Matrix, you start to understand that a lot of the components of Ghostbusters were put together in order to service certain fan or actor expectations. Fargo on my chart is number 4.
Oh, wow.
I find it endlessly rewatchable. It makes me so afraid that I weep. And And I find that there's a tremendous amount of depth to it. It is not as fun as Ghostbusters, but
right. No.
When I became a man, I gave up childish things. And so I'm going Fargo here.
Yeah. Wow. There's so much great performance stuff in Fargo that it's hard to deny its greatness on that level in terms of like what Frances McDormand does with her character, what the way that they're able to make those accents so ingrained and so realistic and feel like these are real people.
And just caricatured enough. Just enough to be kind of funny, but not that you're putting anyone down.
It's
no, I lived in North Dakota for several years, and that is spot on.
Yeah. It's easily top tier Coens for me. Absolutely. But when I was about 8 years old, I was a card carrying fan club Ghostbusters kid. I had the proton pack. I had all of the toys. I wanted desperately to be a Ghostbuster. I made my own traps. I mean, I would go out in the backyard and pretend. It made such a huge influence on me. And it's still to this day, every time I see it, I love the humor and even stuff like the blowjob scene, like you're talking about. To me, when I was a kid, that stuff just went right over my head and it didn't bother me. Right. And as an adult, you know, it's part of a montage. It's just one tiny little scene. They don't show anything really. It's fine. You know, it's just a one-off joke, amongst many.
I'll accept that.
And there's so many great jokes. So yeah, it's tough, but I have to go with the kid in me and let Ghostbusters take the win here over Fargo.
And I feel a little bad being the tiebreaker here because I don't really care about either one.
Yeah, you need to see Ghostbusters again, and so you can.
I have a whole list of movies I need to go back and rewatch because I feel like I might be much more interested in them now. And Ghostbusters and Fargo are both on that list.
Yeah,
the dialogue in Ghostbusters, I think, gets people forget how great it is. That it's unclear a little bit how much of it was improvised, especially in Bill Murray's character. But the rhythms of their speech, it's not really like a lot of other comedies of this era. And I think part of it is because you know, Dan Aykroyd's mind and the way that the way that he wanted these guys to be like plumbers, but like plumber scientists. Right. And that's like the coolest thing ever.
All right, next up we've got Back to the Future against Blade Runner. Sci-fi titans here.
Oh, it's brutal.
On a totally different spectrum, Blade Runner is much more serious and much more heady, much more philosophical, whereas Back to the Future is more of a popcorn flick, more fun, definitely more family-friendly overall. It's got just so much Americana around it, with its 50s setting and this sort of youthful protagonist of Marty McFly. It's just got so much heart to it. I know some people feel like it's weird because of the sort of mother relationship strangeness of it and how it potentially would never fly in a modern script, but somehow it works and it still doesn't seem all that strange to me.
Well, in interesting ways, these are both Oedipal movies, right? So in Back to the Future, we have a man kissing his mother, and in Blade Runner, we have a man killing his father. So we have it's the same. We're talking about the same things here,
right? Just coming at it from completely different viewpoints,
right? Yeah, they're on different drugs. Back to the Future, unlike Ghostbusters, I think that it has aged very well. I think that there is there's a lot of good bones in the science fiction storytelling. I mean, just like Blade Runner is number one on my list. Blade Runner is who I am. It's in many ways, it is a serious, dark, patient, endlessly patient appreciation of beauty at all layers of the human experience, right? Like, so there's like all this visual beauty. There's the beauty of the dialogue. There's the beauty of this concept that you can tell who's human by their empathy, which honestly, I don't think that's necessarily the case with actual humans, you know, but like how, what an optimistic idea, you know?
Right.
And so that I'm picking Blade Runner, but I think, you know, Back to the Future, I think it's such an incredible film that, you know, we're already up against the philosophical underpinnings of this whole podcast, which is that Blade Runner is not everyone. It is me, but it is not everyone. And it's not necessarily like this user flick fights. You know, I don't think it necessarily represents the collective tastes. So, you know, but I can't vote against it.
No, Blade Runner is interesting. It definitely is not me. It doesn't do as much for me as it does for you. It's another one that I do need to revisit. I don't have as low opinion of it as I do Ghostbusters or Fargo, but it's one that I think that I feel like there's a lot more to be gleaned from it. I feel like there's a lot more depth that I did not get my first time around with it, and it's one that I want to go back to, not because I'm like, oh, maybe I remembered it wrong, but because I bet that it's one of those movies that gets better every time I watch it. That being said, I have seen Back to the Future several times, and that one absolutely for me gets better every time I watch it. What I really love about it is that even in the midst of this sort of this odd story where you have these weird undertones of, you know, the weird relationship between mother and son and some really unpleasant scenes with the villain toward the end, but there's just such a sense of, it's the perfect comedy adventure. Like, there's the mix of humor and the mix of excitement from the adventure is just absolutely perfectly balanced for me.
Yep.
And I love how consistent the time travel is within this story, that that they do all sorts of really interesting, fun things with it. And then get to explore that world further because they've built up something that makes a lot of sense and is fun to play around in. So Back to the Future is I'm pretty sure it's in my top 20. Blade Runner's a little further down. But so at this point in my life, I'd have to vote for Back to the Future.
Yeah, it's Back to the Future and Ghostbusters were both pretty influential films for me. They both definitely had impact. I absolutely wanted a DeLorean. I absolutely wanted a time machine. I built time machines in my bedroom. I felt like there's got to be a way to build a flux capacitor. It's got to be real.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah,
it takes a blow to the head, right?
Right.
Yes.
I just got to dream about it on the toilet. Blade Runner, I think, I remember the first time I saw it was probably on TV when I was too young to really completely grasp it in its entirety. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it a handful of times since. And I do feel like there's definitely a lot to it. There's the layers are there. I'm really excited about this new film, the Blade Runner 2049.
I'm hesitantly excited.
It looks like it should extend Blade Runner out in a way that might be really exciting and put some new spins on it. So, you know, some people are massive Blade Runner fans. Like, obviously, Doug, you're a huge Blade Runner fan. And I think it's because of that perfect blend of noir and sci-fi and the Vangelis score and all of the just grittiness of it. It really kind of it made its mark, and it definitely influenced a lot of other filmmakers and a lot of other sci-fi. The genre as a whole has a lot to nod to Blade Runner, but for me personally, I have to go with Back to the Future. It's one of my core films. If there were ever a film that represented me, it's got to be Back to the Future.
Awesome. Okay, I just want to have. I want to have two quick sidebars. One, I want to talk about Crispin Glover. I want to talk about what, you know, what a national treasure he is. and that somehow Zemeckis was able to harness him. He was able, I picture him like putting like a bit in his mouth because he's crazy. Yeah. Like he's legitimately a crazy person. He should be institutionalized. Mm-hmm. But like the character of the father is such a throwaway character with any other actor in there.
Right.
Absolutely. He makes that character memorable because I don't think Crispin Glover could not be memorable.
Yeah, he's just so adorably awkward.
Sidebar number two. So this will now, with the remake or the sequel to Blade Runner, this is now, as I understand it, the third Harrison Ford franchise that he has reawakened, right? So this is sort of like a new trilogy. What
nice choice of word there.
Yes. Right. So what is left for him to dredge back up from the 80s?
Witness 2.
Witness 2. There we go. John Book. John Book, he returns.
Regarding Henry again.
That would be depressing to start that movie all over. It'd be like everything that happened in the first one doesn't count now.
Yeah. It's interesting to see old Harrison Ford in all these roles for sure. Trying to
I need to make a boat payment.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Hopefully he makes it work in the new Blade Runner for sure. Okay. Next up, we've got Pulp Fiction up against The Usual Suspects. Both movies I really don't care for. I'm going to let you guys start because I'm not really sure which one I like less.
Usual Suspects has been one I have not been eager to revisit because I'm worried I won't like it as much. I really enjoyed it the first time I saw it, primarily because I was on a huge Kevin Spacey kick. And absolutely love him in that. He's so interesting, and the acting choices he makes are just so fun to watch. And so I enjoy it primarily because of him. And I'm not sure if going back, I can't even remember if I knew the ending, which I'm not going to spoil for anybody who hasn't seen it, I guess.
Sure.
But I can't even remember if I knew it, but I remember enjoying the rest of it so much. Pulp Fiction was the first Tarantino movie I ever saw, and I was thoroughly underwhelmed. Knowing more of his style now, it is, again, one that I would like to check out again at least a little bit, because I'll know, now that I'm more familiar with his style, and I've liked a lot of his other films, right. I feel like I could watch the first, like, 15 minutes of Pulp Fiction and could tell right away whether it was going to be a better experience this time around or not. If not, then I wouldn't want to rewatch the whole thing, but if I was enjoying that the same way that I do the opening of Inglourious Basterds or Reservoir Dogs, I think there might be stuff that I missed because I wasn't expecting it. But at the time I was really underwhelmed, and so I would definitely vote Usual Suspects.
I think in this case I am going to go with Pulp Fiction. There is a more accessible kind of Swiss watch plot. I'm a huge fan of plots like that, that really have to be incredibly well written, not necessarily in terms of dialogue. Pulp Fiction has the better dialogue, but in terms of someone had to really scope this out with a lot of index cards and post-it notes on a wall.
Right.
Right. And I have a tremendous respect for a writer that can do that so well. Ralph Macchiari was the writer of The Usual Suspects, and he went on to do some amazing films, including The Way of the Gun, which is an underrated film. And I think, in rewatching The Usual Suspects, especially once you get the twist ending, I found myself getting a little bit impatient with some of the scenes, especially knowing that you don't know how much of it is bullcrap.
Right.
And so, like, mm-hmm. there is such a thing as a twist ending so hard, such as at the end of mm-hmm. Jacob's Ladder, that it nullifies the whole movie. It's like you just wasted your time, audience. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's one way that you could look at it if you got a chip on your shoulder like I do. I think Pulp Fiction was able to it was able to have more fun with violence and complicated plot. And again, I have a lot of respect for that.
Yeah. Usual Suspects.
So far, Doug and I have chosen completely opposite on every matchup. So this is going to totally be fun.
That's great.
Audience, we worked this out offline. Yeah. We decided we're going to be enemies.
Yeah.
Usual Suspects definitely gave me that vibe. After the movie was over, I was like, why did I even bother? It just definitely left a bad taste in my mouth. and overall, I didn't really find it that entertaining. Like, it felt very monotonous and kind of like drudgery to get through it.
It's heavy. I mean, it's yeah. Some of the scenes with what's his face and the whole romantic subplot, like it's the way that it's filmed and the lighting and the really slow talking.
Yeah.
It just drags you down, which can be an effective cinematic technique if you use it right.
Sure.
Maybe they didn't do it right here.
Yeah. And Pulp Fiction, I've given it several tries, and for whatever reason, there are plenty of other Tarantino works that I'm a big fan of. I think Kill Bill is fantastic. I really like Reservoir Dogs. I really like parts of Inglourious Basterds, not all of it, but most of it. I think Jackie Brown is actually better than Pulp Fiction. I'm trying to think what else.
I'd accept that.
What else is better than Pulp Fiction? Even Hateful Eight, I think, is much better than Pulp Fiction. I feel like it got a lot of hype because of its structure. And like you said, it is well executed in the sense that it took some planning to make it work. But I don't know if it makes it a great film. It feels disjointed, and it feels like it's a lot of individual scenes, but not really much of a movie. Like
that was how I felt about it as well, that I couldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could if I worked hard enough to try to put the pieces together, I could, but I wasn't particularly enjoying any of the individual scenes to care about how they fit into the whole, even though I'm totally willing to believe that they did.
Right.
I never thought about Pulp Fiction as essentially an anthology movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it is. Yeah. It's a bunch of little tiny novellas,
right?
You know, poorly printed that have been filmed.
And that's the point, right? That's the whole idea. I guess I will give it to Pulp Fiction here because at least it went for it. You know, it swung for the fences on it, and it does have a great soundtrack. You know, Miserlou became, you know, basically everybody knows that song, even if you're not into surf guitar rock. You know, you know that song because of that film. I think Uma Thurman came out of nowhere with Pulp Fiction a little bit. Certainly John Travolta and Samuel Jackson kind of had massive resurgences because of Pulp Fiction. And everybody does a solid job in their character roles, that they made really memorable characters in a movie that I think is just a tiny bit overrated. But Pulp Fiction is going to beat The Usual Suspects. Okay, next up we've got Psycho against Armageddon. So on one hand, we've got probably one of the top masterpieces of horror film by one of the best film directors of all time, Alfred Hitchcock. And then we have a Michael Bay movie, which is about some oil workers that get hired to somehow save the planet from destruction. That's basically the general plot of Armageddon, right?
Something like that.
Sure. You see, they're oil derrick workers,
right?
Who are trained to become astronauts in 72 hours.
Yes.
Yep.
That's right. And it's got Steve Buscemi and Michael Clark Duncan and Bruce Willis and a bunch of other characters that I can't
remember. Ben Affleck.
Yes, Ben Affleck.
I think Steve Buscemi was bowfingered into that film. I don't think he knew that it was a movie.
You know, to be fair, when I saw Armageddon in 1998, I did actually genuinely get emotionally invested in the plot of the movie, which seems ridiculous.
Yeah. Me too. Every time I do.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's really strange. And I think that this is a tremendous credit. Maybe, I don't know, we give Michael Bay credit for this or something, but it's like these perfect mixes of images and sounds,
right?
And music. It's effective.
Yeah, like I really do care that Bruce Willis is giving up everything for Ben Affleck and Liv Tyler for some reason. It as ridiculous as the movie is and as over the top as it is, I found myself totally enraptured with it. So
he's dying for our sins.
Yeah, you know, it's not meant to be anything more than it is. It is a popcorn film. It is a blockbuster. It's an explosion movie. It's Michael Bay. You know, it is what it is. It's supposed to be entertainment, and it's supposed to give you that time in the movie theater. Now, Psycho. I don't know how we can not pick Psycho here. It's just that.
Yeah, no,
good.
I'm picking Psycho. Yeah, it is. I mean, I think that it deserves to be said that what cemented Psycho in popular culture was the first act, right? Like, you know, that people forget
yes.
about all of the, you know, sinking the cars into the swamp and like, oh, you're looking for your sister. And like, there's a kind of a plot that takes a while to kind of unravel.
Right.
While you forget kind of what happened in the first act. But the first act is so amazing in terms of its film craft. Can I, is that too pretentious to say film craft?
No, sure. It's definitely craft.
Go for it. Yes.
It's, you know, he went out of his way to make you think that the movie was going this way and then suddenly left turn. Mm-hmm. And nobody expected it. And that's why he made a point to say, if you're going to see Psycho, you have to come before the movie starts. Like, he wouldn't let anyone come into the theater halfway through, which I thought was fun.
No, I am 100% voting Psycho on this. I think Psycho's brilliant. And I watched Armageddon for the first time last year.
Okay.
And it was...
not even fair. It is for a particular point in time. It was the 1998. The zeitgeist was ripe for this kind of movie.
I really like disaster movies. I love disaster movies.
Me
I
too.
Think they're so much fun, and I think that Armageddon is a waste of a disaster movie. It has, like, I don't think any of the characters work. I don't think any of the humor works. The humor is horrifying. Mm-hmm. And visually it doesn't really, like, I would expect something like that to be really, I would expect that to be kind of powerful seeing the disaster and seeing the devastation around. And it's just, Michael Bay relies so heavily on explosions and nothing, like there's almost nothing else except look at something and it'll blow up. And there's no build up to it. There's no fallout from it. It's just explosion after explosion after explosion. And after about 15 minutes of that, I realized that that's all it's going to be, that we're not going to get any kind of variety in the type of disaster we're seeing. We're not going to see any kind of impact on anybody else other than that something exploding behind them. And it's just, it to me, it felt like such a lazy way to make this story. And I'm a big fan of the disaster movies that nobody likes. Like, I really like Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah.
But it's because they found interesting creative ways to make that disaster happen. And so each time something happened, it was a new fear. It was a new, like, oh my gosh, this
right.
is what's happening. Whereas Armageddon just sticks with the same script over and over again. And there's no imagination in that. And so I was hoping that I was hoping that I'd really enjoy it and get a kick out of it and enjoy it as... for exactly what I thought it would be. And just everything about it was so flat. And then you compare that to something like Psycho, which has a lot less action happening in it, but is such, Hitchcock is such a master of that build up and that fallout that we don't get from Michael Bay in this movie at all. And so you have this dramatic turn halfway through. And then if you're looking at it from an action standpoint, nothing happens for like an hour.
Right. Right.
And yet the mystery that it unravels is so fascinating as we're just trying to figure out what exactly is going on. And so I think one of these really I mean, I don't think anybody would deny that Psycho shows just a master film craft, as you said, master of camera, master director running the show. And I think Armageddon is the opposite of that in every possible way.
Now, have you folks seen Deep Impact? I have not.
Yes,
I have not.
Deep Impact is not as bad as you would think.
Okay, because I mean, it is ranked lower globally.
Yes, it is. And it came out almost the same time as Armageddon. It's very similar plot, but it takes itself even more seriously and tries to be, I don't know, like just over the top dramatic a lot.
We didn't get an Aerosmith song out of that one.
Yeah, no Aerosmith song.
Why even get out of bed, really?
Yeah. I'm a massive disaster movie fan. I really like 2012. I like Day After Tomorrow.
Love 2012.
I like all that stuff. It's ridiculous and fun. I really want to see San Andreas, the one with The Rock. It looks ridiculous and dumb and fun.
Well, I'd watch The Rock in anything.
Yeah.
That's great.
But yeah, let's be real, folks. It's got to be Psycho here. Psycho is going to beat Armageddon.
Preach it.
Okay, next up we've got Shaun of the Dead against Raiders of the Lost Ark. Now, Raiders of the Lost Ark is in my top 20. Shaun of the Dead is not. But Shaun of the Dead is fun. It's got a lot of wonderful visual stuff going on. The comic beats are second to none in terms of how well timed things are in that movie, how well choreographed things are, the use of editing, the use of the set. There's like foreground jokes, background jokes, all kinds of stuff. It's almost like Airplane, like the Zucker Brothers movies, in a way where there are things happening in the frame that are funny multiple ways. So it's a comedy that definitely benefits from its visual storytelling, and the performances are really strong. But at the end, it's still basically just a zombie movie. But now we have Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is maybe Spielberg's best movie, possibly. It's maybe Harrison Ford's best role, depending on whether or not you're a huge Han Solo fan versus a Indiana Jones fan. And it's possibly the best adventure film ever made. What do you guys think?
Shaun of the Dead is, I love Edgar Wright, but I think Shaun of the Dead is my lowest ranked of his. Now, I'm pretty sure it's still in my top, like, 300.
Okay.
But because I just really like Edgar Wright, but it's definitely my least favorite of the Cornetto trilogy. It's definitely below Scott Pilgrim. I think it's solid, but it doesn't blow me away as much as some of the other stuff that Wright has done. Not as much as that. Raiders of the Lost Ark is one that every time I watch it, I find new things to enjoy and new things to laugh at and to be kind of amazed by. Yeah. I think it's one of those, I really like movies that are able to take it, like Back to the Future. You know, when I said that Back to the Future was the perfect comedy adventure, I was like, Raiders of the Lost Ark comes close-ish for me as well. Because even though, you know, it's billed primarily as an adventure, there's a lot of comedy in there that really makes the tone what it is and makes the tone as great as it is. And I'm pretty sure Raiders is in my top 20. If not, it should be. And Shaun of the Dead is, while great, is a little bit lower.
This has been a difficult couple minutes for me because
we both went first. I mean, so you could think about this one.
I needed this moment to prepare. Cause like, I mean, I'm going with Raiders. But there were long periods when I wavered a lot more than I thought I would. I think part of it is the problem. I forget what TV Tropes calls it when it, you know, when it seems like Seinfeld is cliche, but it's because Seinfeld invented the cliches. In Raiders of the Lost Ark, a lot of times when I watch it now, it comes across that way, that a lot of these beats and tropes that it invented, they don't have an impact on me the way that they used to. and that they wore themselves out a little bit, whereas Shaun of the Dead is completely, I don't know what's the right metaphor, it's pointy with innovation. Mm-hmm. Like every part of it is edgy and surprising, and especially within a genre that's fairly well established, like the zombie subgenre.
Right.
So this was closer than I thought it would be. But I think that structurally, and the fact that it doesn't have a tongue in its cheek the whole time, I think Raiders of the Lost Ark wins this for me.
Yeah.
Do you think that Shaun of the Dead will, because it definitely was an early, more mainstream sort of meta zombie comedy story, and we're seeing a lot more of that kind of thing now. Do you think that in 30 years that we're going to be so inundated with the tropes that Shaun of the Dead, kind of the way that they inverted them, do you think that it's going to suffer from the same effect, or do you think that there's something about Shaun of the Dead that's going to stay?
Well, Edgar Wright's specific genius is in the visual, the way he can tell jokes with just visuals.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that I'm sure, I haven't seen a lot of the copycats of the zombie comedies, but I'm sure that they try and fail to do that.
And we're sort of in a bad time, I think, in terms of comedy in film. there's a real dearth
specifically
of
American comedy.
Comedy.
I mean, yeah. I saw this really great analysis on YouTube that really explained that's one of the things that Edgar Wright brings to the table is a British sense of visual humor, which is not, it's not something we do very well here.
Yeah, and his editing is what makes it. What makes it work?
Brilliant.
There's a way to do editing well, and then there's a way to do editing lazy, where you just have your two camera and it's just shoulder, 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 people talking on a couch, boring comedy, or, you know, where it's just like, let's put the actors in a room and hope that they are able to improv their way through the scene. Whereas Shaun of the Dead or any Edgar Wright comedy is precise. It is, everybody is exactly where they're supposed to be in the frame. It looks like a painting. It's so well composed, and the comedy works specifically because of the way Edgar Wright designed it to be funny.
Edgar Wright is the David Fincher of comedy. Please discuss.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, for sure.
I would definitely agree with that.
Yes. Yeah, and so since the innovation comes through the technique rather than through the narrative choices, it's going to be a lot more, we're going to get fewer copycats that actually can take that and work with that. I buy that. That makes sense.
So as much as we are admiring and giving lots of props to Shaun of the Dead, we are still going to go with Raiders of the Lost Ark. Next up, we've got Zootopia against The Green Mile. Very different movies here. The Green Mile is a Stephen King short story, and it's directed by Frank Darabont and has Michael Clarke Duncan and Tom Hanks, and it's a prison movie. And then we've got Zootopia, which is a Disney film, 3D animation with lots of talking animals. Really interesting world building, kind of a heavy-handed message sort of plot, but well done, well executed. Not sure which of these is actually the better film. What do you think?
I honestly was surprised that Zootopia came off as well as it did. I have a tremendous suspicion of modern animated comedies that are not Pixar. Pixar's, and this is Disney animation.
Right.
Right, which is apparently different. But Pixar storytelling is so unimpeachable that these, the other animation studios, they uniformly fail to live up to it. But they got some jokes into Zootopia that are some of my favorite jokes in all of film. The sloth in the DMV scene. Oh, yeah. I almost choked to death. My wife was really really concerned. I almost choked to death in the trailer. So I've seen the trailer a number of times, and then saw the movie and still laughed at it.
Yeah.
Because it's a patience that you don't get in children's comedy.
Right.
That absolutely. They brought to, and there's a lot of jokes like that in the film. So I think that it wins. It's not going to beat The Green Mile because its story, the bones of its story are not quite as robust as I need them to be, but it is an astonishing accomplishment in terms of comedy, like children's, adult, whatever. I think it's a great comedy. The Green Mile, it has an edge for me, an unfair advantage, because I read the books that, and not only read them, but listened to them on audio, which is a very intimate experience. I'm on my newspaper route as a child in the dark, wrong place to listen to Stephen King, just, you know, word of advice. But, I will put this up against Shawshank Redemption as maybe the best Stephen King adaptation, in terms of its emotional closeness, that you feel that, you know, the camera really, really kind of creeps in on some of these actors, and without having to, you know, they don't abuse the voiceover the way that they totally could. And, you know, to make it feel like a novel. I really enjoyed it. It's a very sad, upsetting movie.
Yeah.
But I find it very affecting.
It's almost like a fantasy film in some ways.
Yes, that's precisely what it is. Yeah,
yeah. It's interesting. This is Zootopia. There's a wonderful extended, I think it's at least an hour, if not 2 hour, documentary on Zootopia, and talking about all of the struggles that the team went through to get the movie to come together. And it's a matter of, originally they had the whole story centered around the fox character instead of the bunny character. Mm. And when they got to a certain point, they showed it to Pixar, and Pixar was like, that's not really going to work. That it doesn't, you're, something's wrong with your story. And then they had to restructure the whole thing, basically like throw the movie out and start over. And once they repositioned it through the eyes of the bunny character, it sort of made the whole movie work and changed everything. So it's if you have some time, go to YouTube, look up Zootopia behind the scenes documentary, something like that, and check it out, because it's really interesting, really, really good behind the scenes look on how a movie like that has to work.
Yeah, I was impressed by Zootopia because not only was it just a genuinely entertaining film for kids and for adults, but I was really impressed with the sections of their message that they chose to present. Because we've seen, we've seen so many times, don't judge other people by how they look. Yeah. That's kind of ingrained in us. But I think Zootopia was really fascinating in how it handled the in clearly being partly included being a story about racism, looking at the people who say looking at, especially with our bunny lead character, as somebody who thinks, well, I'm friends with this fox, I think he's fine, and so therefore I'm good.
Right.
And so the scene, I remember watching it, and the scene that jumped out at me was the press conference scene where she is saying all these things that in her mind make her the good guy, that she's saying all the right things. She's not saying anything like all predators are evil, but she doesn't realize. And so I love that this, it's just a masterful cutting back and forth between her, what she's saying, and seeing how clearly she thinks that she's in total right here, that she is the good person here. And then cutting back to the fox character, who you just see that he realizes that she still has all these thoughts about predators that she doesn't think are a problem, and that he realizes that she still has this sitting in her somewhere. And I just thought that was a level of depth and a level of deep questioning of that topic that I do not see very often in children's movies. And I was kind of wowed by how they were able to bring this in and really look at that from that angle. And I think they're right. I think it wouldn't have worked with the fox as the central character, because we needed to see this character who is so convinced that she has she has rooted out any bias in her mind. There's nothing left, and doesn't realize, and so can't see anything that's left there for what it is. So I just remember being really, really impressed with Zootopia for taking that topic and finding something new and relevant and interesting to say about it in a way that made sense for kids. And Green Mile, I liked a lot. I've seen it twice, I think. And I remember thinking it was interesting both times. It did not hit me on an emotional level the way that I expected it to. I think it was one that it kind of wore me out. And so, because like about 2 hours in, I was like, all right, well, if it ends here, this is a great movie. And then I just didn't have any energy left to connect with it the rest of the time. But I think it's an excellent movie. I think I would give the nod to Zootopia myself, but I think either one, I think Green Mile would be, I would be fine with Green Mile winning the matchup as well.
Yeah, any kind of prison movie, you're stuck in a location, you're stuck with these characters, and if you're not enjoying it, if you're not having fun with it, or if you're not invested with it, that makes it hard. Makes it hard to really sink into the movie. I feel like I've only seen Green Mile the one time, and I believe I saw it in the theater, but I can't recall. It's like in my mind, I'm not sure if I saw it in the theater or if I saw it in video. It probably doesn't matter, but I definitely only saw it the one time. So my overall memory of it is good, but not strong. Zootopia, of course, is a much newer film, so it's more fresh in my mind. I do feel like it's very good, Zootopia, and it's good for a children's film and good as an animated film and good as a script. But there's something about it that still feels like it's slightly incomplete, and I'm not really quite sure what it is.
It lacks greatness.
there's something, there's something that's not quite 100% about it. And it's maybe it's because of its problems putting the script together and trying to find its voice. It definitely feels like they were they had this core message that they wanted to put into a plot and make it work into a movie. And while I think it gets about 90% there, there's something that's not quite there.
Yeah, no, there's a reason this wasn't an easy win for me. Zootopia, I think it does a lot of things very, very well and very impressively, but it's not. It doesn't rise to the ranks of any of my favorite Pixars, for example.
Sure. Yeah, it's like you can admire it. You think it's good, but it's not ever going to fall into the Hall of Fame of Disney movies, of animated films. It's just not. It's not going to do it. So for that case, then, I think we're going to go with The Green Mile over Zootopia. All right. So now we've got The Full Monty against Die Hard. All right, Hannah.
Full Monty is amazing. Okay. So, no, I'm pretty sure it was the last time I was on the show that I defended The Full Monty and then voted for the other movie. No, Full Monty is amazing.
It is really
I like Die Hard a lot. I think Die Hard is a lot of fun. I know a lot of people think it is, you know, the best action movie out there. And it's really good. I don't tend to like action movies, and Die Hard sells me on it. But I think Full Monty is just brilliant. It's one of those movies that that takes the... It sets something up. It sets up a premise and an expectation, and then takes it and makes it a lot more meaningful and thoughtful than you could ever have imagined that story would be.
Right.
And every single actor in it, it really is even though we have Robert Carlyle as the center of it, you really have an ensemble cast of people who are all so interesting in their own right and have their own reasons for doing what they're doing in the movie. And it's just every scene brings out a little bit of one of these characters, and by the end you're so invested in them. I think the final scene, the final musical number, shall we call it, is one of the, to me, it's one of the most emotionally powerful endings I've maybe ever seen for a film. I'm just so excited for them and so yes. happy for them that right. they've been able to pull off this thing and for what it has meant to them. It's an inspirational movie in all the right ways. When a lot of times movies that try to actually be inspirational flop horribly but this is so much, the characters are so real and they're so interesting and it's so funny and it's such a creative premise. And as much as I enjoy Die Hard and think there's so much good in it, it does not on any level connect with me the way of the Full Monty does. And so there's no doubt in my mind that I like Die Hard a lot, but the Full Monty is 100% getting my vote.
These movies both make me weep with joy in totally different ways.
Yeah, I'm having another one of those moments. Yeah, I agree with Hannah.
Really?
So Die Hard is 330 on my chart, and Full Monty is 32.
Oh, wow.
Okay. I've been trying to figure out is why, right? I think that Die Hard is more important for its contributions to the genre than right. and sort of how it changed action movies for the better than it is as a movie itself. I think that if you just look at it on its own, and you know, Bruce Willis being a little bit hammy, right? Like he's fresh off of that television
Moonlighting,
right? Yeah. So he's mm-hmm. he's a comedian, right? Like he's in his career up until this point has been as a comedian.
Yeah.
And I think that there is trouble in how the components that are now standard action movie components, back then they were still trying to figure out how to put them together. And I think there's a lot, you know, Alan Rickman was so crucial to giving the movie the impact that it needed. But I think that in terms of the emotional impact and cohesion, I think that the Full Monty is better and more effective, certainly as a comedy, but also in terms of like trying to kind of teach you something like about about what it means to be a person. And I think that I don't give action movies a pass for that responsibility. I think that you can do that. And I think some of the other Die Hard movies even do it better than Die Hard itself does. I mean, and certainly there's action movies that do it better. And I just take more away from the Full Monty. So it's got my pick. I'm as surprised as anyone.
Wow. Yeah, I absolutely think Full Monty's great. I loved it. It definitely made me tear up at the end. I was smiling from ear to ear. And what you said, Doug, I think is the real point here is that Die Hard is so much more important of a film that I feel like it does a disservice to not choose it here. Like the Full Monty, for all of its success as an individual story, I don't feel like the majority of people are going to remember it.
The
much.
Full Monty forever changed Northern England male stripper movies.
It's all very, the ones that came after.
Very specific niche there. Die Hard is just so perfect in terms of action. It's such a well-crafted combination of really wonderfully designed bad guys too, like all of the sort of weirdly Eastern European, not sure where they're from. Are they German? Are they, you know,
and they weren't faceless. Like even the ones that didn't get lines, they all had like idiosyncrasies and weird ways that they dress. They didn't have to do that, but they did. It was great.
And I don't know if that's John McTiernan, that did that to pull those performances out, or if it's the script or what it is that made it all work. But there's something about the building has character, the really strong relationship between John McClane and his wife, this sort of antagonistic, you know, he's there in their divorce. It's like weird. And you feel for him right off the gate, you know, like that he's, trying really hard, and it's at Christmas. So there's like all these strange components to it that would never be in, you know, a movie like Rambo or Predator, or, you know, any of these other like super hardcore action movies. It feels realistic. It feels like it's just this guy that's there trying to make his marriage work somehow, and he gets thrown into the middle of a terrorist plot, strangely, you know, and it draws you in immediately. I remember even drawing up diagrams and plans on trying to figure out how many floors there were on Nakatomi Plaza, and trying to like map out the whole route that Bruce Willis took to get to the roof and then back down and through the elevator shaft and through the ducts and all this stuff. Like I love the whole sort of
that's three references to your childhood hijinks. That's all you get.
I know. That's the thing. Like so much of that is, I guess it hit me at just the right time to really just make my young brain explode in terms of just loving every minute of it. I don't know. It's
movies like this have a appropriate age for sometimes there's an appropriate point in like history for them to come out, for the culture to absorb them, and then there's also the right age for a person to absorb it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if it hits like both at the same time, like that can be very powerful.
I feel bad for, you know, my kids and for younger generations that are kind of see Die Hard and they're not going to understand how perfect it is, and like they're going to see is the imperfections. Maybe not. So I think some people still like Die Hard that are young, but for anybody out there that has not seen Die Hard, please watch Die Hard.
Die Hard is great. I'm voting the other way, but Die Hard is great. Yeah. And this is a question that we've discussed like among flick charters for a long time, is the question of do you look at a movie's greatness in terms of its context in film history and what it did with its previous genre and what it did for the genre going forward, or do you look at them each as individually and as without any of those filters on? And I think this is where those clash a little bit, that Die Hard, mm-hmm. I agree, Die Hard is absolutely more important in the genre than Full Monty was. And yet, if I look at them individually, which is how I tend to do things, unless something hit me, from a very personalized standpoint, unless it hit me because of its innovation at the time, Full Monty, I think, is a stronger individual story. And so it's one of those debates that, like, okay, which way goes for us?
Yeah, you have to go with your heart. I feel like in a lot of these, you know, there's something to be said about technical execution or script writing prowess or acting ability or the director being able to, you know, show his craft. But at a certain point, you know, you as the viewer, you have to look at these movies and you have to come up with a feeling. You have to have an emotional takeaway that impacts you and only you, and that is what determines what you think of a movie. It's you have to throw away everything else and ignore the critics and ignore the importance of, you know, cinema or whatever it is, and if it hits you, it hits you, you know, that's what's important.
And that's why we can end, you know, we can finish up this podcast with two people choosing Full Monty over Die Hard.
Right.
And
right.
This is so how flip chart works.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how it works. And Full Monty is going to beat Die Hard. Okay. Well, that's a wrap then for this episode of Flick Fights. We'll get on to some more ranking and re-ranking in future episodes. But you can follow us on Flick Chart, we're Flick Fights, and you can follow us on Twitter at Flick Fights. And if you want to be a future guest on the show, or you want to send us any kind of feedback, just send us an email to flickfights@flickchart.com. So we'll be back next time with a new special guest and more title fights. But for now, from all of us at Flick Fights, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.